and welcome to Tickets, a podcast series exploring the future of live experiences. Each episode, we take you behind the scenes with the visionaries, producers, and operators delivering some of the most vital and innovative experiences around, from Broadway theatre to international boxing, virtual reality to retail. Tickets aims to join the dots between disciplines, share knowledge and new ideas, and better understand what goes into bringing these experiences to life. My name's Howard Gray. I'm the founder of H Bureau, a specialist consultancy practice helping media, entertainment, and experience companies grow. On the guest list today is Vincent Marini, Chief Creative Officer at Base Entertainment, a live entertainment company with offices in New York, Las Vegas, and Houston. Vincent has a wealth of experience as a director and producer across disciplines including film, theatre, concerts, and magic. He also spent 5 years as the artistic director at one of America's premier state theatres. This is a hugely enjoyable conversation. It's immediately clear how knowledgeable and passionate Vincent is about both his craft and the industry more broadly. Listen on for Vincent's thoughts on the importance of embracing failure, building a hologram touring division, how he went about launching projects in China, and the role that arts and cultural trust play in today's society. Enjoy.
I'm the Chief Creative Officer for Base Entertainment, and basically I'm responsible for any new projects that go on the stage anywhere in the world for the company. So that means everything from developing new work to translating existing projects for major markets around the world, to developing new sort of ways of thinking about live entertainment. And we have a really wonderful staff in Las Vegas and in California and in Houston that all work together to support the various projects that Base has undertaken over the past 10 years.
So before Base, you were at Flat Rock in North Carolina, correct?
Yeah, so I was, for 5 years, I ran the State Theater of North Carolina, and I was the producing artistic director there. And before that, I actually spent about a year and a half freelancing on a project in China with Base. And that's sort of how I got introduced to the company. I got introduced to Scott Zeiger and Brian Becker, who at the time were co-CEOs. And when I got finished, Scott had moved on and was working for Cirque du Soleil Theatrical, running that division. And Brian was still the CEO of Base, and I ended up consulting with both of them actually on different projects. But it became clear that Base had some really specific needs on the creative side and had an ambitious agenda, and they needed someone to help bring that to reality.
So if we go back sort of before Base, mm-hmm. before Flat Rock, mm-hmm. can you maybe explain how you got interested in the arts in the first place and how
sure.
you went from there to becoming an artistic director and to where you are now?
You know, it's funny. There's sort of a line of demarcation in my life because I grew up really mostly involved in sports. And to this day, it's a big part of my life, and I love it. But when I was 11 years old, I had a teacher in middle school that got me very interested in musical theater in particular, and in performing and singing and dancing and things that I had never really thought about before. And it was really through her sort of inspiration through those 3 years in middle school, and then through the continuing that with my teacher in high school, that I really sort of became interested in the arts as a career. And at the time, I thought maybe that would be as a performer, but as time went on, I decided that and came to understand that when you're sort of behind the camera, or when you're sort of backstage, and or when you're a director, you're in a position where there's a little piece of you in everything, and that's feeling can be very addictive. So that's something that I sort of got the bug, that bug in college, and then continued that through some graduate work, and then eventually into the industry.
Did you go straight in as a director after college?
No, well, actually, yes, but it was mostly in film. So I spent a lot of time in film and television for about 3 to 4 years. I went to NYU to grad school there to do some sort of, in my undergrad was mostly in communications in general, specifically in theater and television. And then I spent some time at NYU really sort of diving into the world of film. And then following that, I spent a few years as part of an independent production company doing all kinds of different projects, from entertainment stuff to corporate stuff to sporting events and everything in between. And eventually I ended up navigating back to live theater. I missed the sort of immediacy of it, the live component. I mean, you have so much control over film that it's wonderful in some ways, but also the experience is always the same. So with live entertainment, I missed that sort of immediacy and that immediate gratification and that sense that anything can happen on any night. So I came back into that that area, and during that, I was about 26 years old, and in the town I grew up in southern New Jersey, they had built a large performing arts center as part of an educational institution, and they really didn't know exactly what to do with it, and they hired me to help figure that out, and I didn't really know anything at the time, but being the only employee of a new theater really gave me an opportunity to learn everybody's job. You know, to understand what the marketing, what it meant to be have to market shows, to understand the box office, to understand what a lighting designer and a sound designer does on a granular level, you know, to understand how to deal with agents and how to deal with talent and high level talent. And having that experience and being sort of the person that began it really enabled me to develop, I think, a pretty unique skill set, which is a really broad understanding of technical theater and technical production, a really strong sense for the business of theater and entertainment, and then also a strong sense of who I am as an artist and as a director. So it was sort of a really valuable opportunity that really led to all the other things that happened in my life subsequently.
Got it. So if we fast forward to Flat Rock again, mm-hmm. I guess one of the productions that kind of stood out there was right. Les Mis. So yeah. you tell me a little bit about that, because it was kind of a small town in North Carolina, right? A kind of yeah. prestigious theater, but very boutique, very
it's
small.
It's very interesting. It's a unique situation, actually. It's the State Theater of North Carolina. It's about 25 miles outside of Asheville, North Carolina, which is a beautiful area of the state in the Blue Ridge Mountains. And it, but they welcome 100,000 patrons every year to that theater, mostly from May through September, though they program from all the way from early March all the way through to the end of the Christmas season. So I did a lot of things that I'm very proud of there artistically. We also opened a new theater while I was there. But one of the things that I was certainly the most proud of was the Les Mis production. I think it was a very unique production. One of the reasons I did it is that I have a close friend, Rob Evan, who has been in 7 different shows on Broadway. He played Jekyll and Hyde. He played Jean Valjean on Broadway. Now he's about to star in this new production, Rocktopia, that's opening in a few weeks. And he and I always wanted to do the show together. So it was an opera. He came down and stayed in North Carolina with us for, I don't know, 8 or 9 weeks. We put together a great cast and did what I think is a really unique, original production of the show that to this day I'm really proud of.
Could you maybe go into that a little bit deeper about some of the key decisions you made mm-hmm. to get that working in such a kind of small, unique space? Because it's mm-hmm. traditionally been a relatively big Broadway show. I imagine it's quite challenging when you're working with those constraints. What did you go through in the creative process?
You know, it's funny. I think that in a lot of cases, when you have constraints, it almost forces you to be more creative. Because, you know, listen, I've had both sides of it. You know, I've been in situations where the production budgets are really challenged and the space is really challenged, and in situations where the production budgets were virtually unlimited and the space we were constructing from scratch. So I've seen both sides, and they both obviously have their merits, but I enjoyed the challenge of doing large traditionally large scale shows in a more intimate fashion. We were able to do some pretty creative stuff. Like one of the coolest things about the production is that when the audience came in, the entire proscenium was actually walled up. So it was walled up like a jail would be, with only sort of a couple of windows where there were bars, and it looked like a sort of an older period French jail. And then at the beginning of the show, as the overture, you know, goes and they go into the first bit of singing, the prisoners actually pull the wall down from behind and it breaks into a million pieces. And they start clearing the wall as if they're doing some kind of renovation at the prison that then begins the show. So we were able to do some creative things that I had never seen before. We didn't use a turntable, but we did create sort of what I would call slip stages, which enabled the entire portions of the entire stage to move left to right. We also employed some, I think, really interesting projection technology into it that enabled us to do some just very creative things visually without making major changes every moment of the show. And then ultimately, I think that we, you know, the choreographer, Jennifer Jankesche, and I spent a lot of time thinking about the characters and how the characters move and how to create drama and excitement and scale without always just using scenery. So it was a really, I think, exciting process. We had a great orchestra. We had Kim Scharnberg, one of the great Broadway orchestrators, take the score and compress it down for 10 or 11 musicians. He did a great job with that. It was just a really wonderful experience. Really enjoyed it a lot.
What did you take from that into what you've been doing now? Have you been taking some of those kind of more constrained challenges that you had? Have you taken that into the bigger work and found that it works well?
I mean, I think that we, you know, I think as you go forward, you start to learn more and more about yourself as a creator. And one of the things that I think that I certainly excel at because of the experiences that I've had is finding unique ways of doing sort of complex things. So in a lot of cases, you know, when you think about the experiences at Flat Rock, we didn't have the ability to spend $200,000 on a single effect. We just couldn't do that. But finding unique ways, and by the way, part of it has to do with collaborations, you know, finding people that are willing to sort of get into the weeds with you and figure out how to accomplish great things with limited budgets. And also pushing the limits of those budgets. I mean, finding ways to eke out every dollar that you've got and spend it accordingly. It's something that I think I take with me now. And I think that if you look at the budgets for the shows that we produce and you consider what they physically look like on the stage, I think that they always look like we spent a lot more money than we actually did. And I think part of the reason for that is that experience that I've had over time and the group of collaborators that I've been fortunate enough to surround myself with over the past, you know, 15 or 20 years.
You mentioned earlier that you were working in film and some corporate work for quite a while, and then you were kind of drawn back to theatre because of its live and visceral kind of nature of it. Something that's always fascinated me about that is that it's not just a live experience that's happening once. Mm. Like a sports player will go and play a different team every single night. I was watching NBA last night, and they'll be on the road somewhere else tonight.
Of course.
But in theatre, it's delivering that show, but at that same level and the same quality every single night, from performance one to performance 1,000.
Yeah.
How, as a kind of creative director and producer, how do you ensure that the team are operating at that kind of level on a consistent basis? I imagine that's challenging.
It is to a degree. I think that there are a few different ways that I mean, it's something I think about often because a lot of the shows that I'm involved in have to run for many, many years, or we want them to, at least. So I think that the first thing is that I try to set a very clear artistic vision for the team and for the cast. And I think that I try to hire people that all have that same sort of sense of pride in what they do and ability to buy into that vision. I think that one of the great things about theater or about music is the collaborative nature of it, and the fact that when you have the right people around you, as long as you're all rowing in the same direction, you are often in a position where everything is additive. You know, people that you bring into the project end up finding ways of doing things that were much better than what you could have ever imagined. So I think that the first part is setting a concrete and clear vision for everyone involved, from the cast to the creative team, even through the production staff. I think that the second thing is that, you know, I've been very fortunate to work with some really talented stage managers over the years. And I think that having the right stage manager, someone that that is really sort of simpatico with the director and understands what the director demands is really important, because, you know, he or she is the person on the ground every day making sure that what you created with the rest of the team is maintained. And then the third thing is that I think that shows need to have enough breathing room to go through natural evolution. So that I think it's smart and important to have a really clear structure that is critical, and a series of sort of principles that we don't walk away from. But as different cast members come in and as the show moves forward in time, it's important that the show has some kind of life of its own. It's about a living, breathing organism. It shouldn't just be something that, like a poster that you put on the wall and stays on the wall. It should have some sense of life to it. So I think that working, you know, working with the stage manager or working with the rest of the creative team to help and allow the performers to have that space over time while still maintaining sort of the critical nature of the work, I think is important.
That third point particularly, I think, is really interesting. I was listening to a podcast called Desert Island Discs, which is a classic British radio show. Uh-huh. And Christopher Nolan was a guest, the film director. And he was talking about how he comes to his shoots extremely well prepared. And he's well known for not going over budget, and the studios don't meddle very much. And I thought that's great. But obviously within film, you've got that margin that you don't really have in theatre. So. For you, to that point, when you're going from show one to show 1,000, and that evolution, how much do you change? Well, after opening night, how much would you maybe change the production from maybe show one to show 10 or show one to show 30?
I think that depends. It depends really specifically on the project, because there are some projects that I've done and felt like, you know, I think we really got this right. This is the right show at the right time in the right place with the right people, and in those cases, it tends to be something that we tweak. Occasionally make adjustments too, but more or less sort of stays what it is. There have been other times where I've done shows where we, you know, what we had on opening night, we still felt needed to be worked on. We felt like there was still work to do, that we needed to continue to find ways of improving it, whether that was adding a song, whether that was sort of making the appropriate cuts, whether that was making changes to the cast or to the technical elements of the show. I really do think it's very show specific, but I will tell you that I tend to not go back all the time to shows that I directed or wrote or was involved in that way. I'll spend a lot of time during previews, and then I'll go back to give notes on occasion. But I think that part of me likes that part of the process where you let it go. Where, you know, you've put this together with this team of people, and now it sort of takes on its own life, and you're there to sort of guide it along and provide some input along the way. But I like that sort of catch and release moment where you're like, okay, this, I spent 3 years of my life on this. Now it's time to let this go and, you know, and hold it close to my heart, but sort of move on to the next thing. And like I said, I enjoy going back and giving notes, but I'm not usually one to like sit in the audience night after night and spend a lot of time at the actual show.
I feel like the comment you made about that first job in Jersey, in that new theatre where you effectively were involved in everything, that seems to have shaped quite a lot of your career, doing everything. And as someone who operates as both a creative director and more of an exec producer, how would Vincent the producer work with Vincent the director? Do you think you get along well, or would it be challenging?
A lot of people ask that question, and I think that, you know, Vincent the director always wants things to be as good as they can be, and Vincent the producer sort of is really good in finding creative ways to provide the director part of me with those opportunities. So what I mean by that is that when I look at a budget for a show, I don't pay a ton of attention to the categories. I care about the number at the bottom of the sheet. Because when something is budgeted, it's done at a point in the process where the creative process is not finished yet. So there's a business part of this that requires that number to be met. But then how you get to that number is where the creativity comes in. And I think that great executive producers are people that understand that the creative process requires you to be able to be nimble and to make complex on the ground decisions that hopefully will turn out a lot better since you now have more information than they did 6 months ago when you budgeted the show. So my theory as a producer, it doesn't matter if I'm the director or I'm working with another director, which I've done many, many times over the years, I try to give that director as much freedom as I can to execute their concept, support them as much as I possibly can, and I don't allow myself to be confined by, well, this category, line 1237, says there's $70,000 in that budget. We can't change that. I don't believe in that. I believe that those are sort of fluid documents, and that as long as at the end of the day, that number that's at the bottom, we hit that number, how we get there, I think it's critical to have a producer that understands that you need to have flexibility. I'd also say that as a producer and as a director, I think that I've tried recently, especially, to sort of embrace failure. I mean, if you are in this particular business and you don't fail relatively regularly on some level, you're probably not being bold enough. So I think that, you know, if you're going to be in entertainment long enough, you're going to do things that, with the best of intentions, that just don't work out. And I think that one of the things that you need to be able to do is to just really don't ignore those failures, but really examine them. And then as you go into the next project, carry those lessons with you. Because in a lot of cases, I know personally, I can say that a lot of the things that I failed at over time are the things that ended up shaping me much more than the successes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think it's very difficult to accept failure. We all have ego, right? Do you think it's more the producer in you or the director in you that's become more open to failure, or is it just
generally? I think it's the producer, because on the director's side, it's very personal, and it becomes you put so much of yourself into the production that it feels personal when it's not successful. It feels like, you know, you feel a sense of personal rejection by it. But as a producer, it's a little bit more nuts and boltsy. You know, it's a little bit more about, you know, creating the right formula. So I think that as a producer, it's a little bit easier to step back and say, well, that was the wrong choice, than it is as a director because as a director, you know, you're personally involved. You clearly understand the intention. You're very much on the ground in the weeds every day. It's just a different, it's harder to step back in those situations, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, absolutely. I've spent a lot of time with producers in other fields, whether it's film or advertising, and I think the same thing pervades. And
yeah.
I think what you said about the exec producer role being actually very creative, in that, yes, there are line items, but it's then within that it's getting creative about how do you make the most of them and how do you turn someone's vision, fulfill the vision in the way that the director wants to and the show should happen. That's really interesting. And I think a lot of people maybe overlook that a little bit.
Well, I think it's really important, because I think that as a director goes through any project, they discover things along the way that they just didn't know at the beginning. And you're limiting the creative process substantially if you're saying to a director who feels like a certain element has become critical now that they've gotten into the process to say, well, I'm sorry, we're just not budgeted for that. That's just not the way I produce shows. What I say is, we can make that choice, and here are the ways we can make it. It's by making these other choices. And I think giving people that kind of flexibility, I think, is really important. And, you know, to me, if you're an executive producer that's going to work with high-level creative teams, you need to be able to understand their process and understand how to support them the best you can within the confines that you have.
Thinking about producers a little more, we're sitting here in middle of New York City, in the base office, where we're right next to Times Square and Broadway, really, really close, just a stone's. I walked from Times Square here and walked past probably 10 theaters on the way through.
Sure.
I was really interested to get your take on the kind of impresarios of maybe the past and today. Who do you think, maybe in the recent past and also today and potentially the future, are the kind of most exciting producers out there right now, whether it's in theater or more immersive entertainment?
I mean, first of all, there are a million great producers and directors that I've come across over the years that I've learned, you know, a lot from, certainly. But without getting too specific, because I don't want to leave anybody out, I would say that I think what's very interesting right now is that there are a couple of different parts of sort of the future of entertainment that are all coalescing at the same time. There's this understanding and sense that we need to, as content creators, find ways of getting the audience more directly involved in the product. You know, the buzzword is sort of immersive productions, but I don't know that anybody has yet got that exactly right yet. I think it's sort of a process that we're learning, because one of the hard things is that an audience member, the audience is not a single body. It's a bunch of individual people who all have very different understandings and desires on how involved in the show they want to be. Some people go to shows because they like the escapism of being able to step away from everything and just sort of zone out and be lost in that world. Other people love things where they can be directly involved and making choices, etc. So developing a piece of theater or a piece of entertainment that is able to simultaneously serve both of those desires and all the gray in between is a very complex thing. And I think that everybody in the industry, no matter whether it's, you know, the Broadway community or the sort of the broader entertainment community, is looking at interesting ways of getting the audience more immersed in the storytelling. And I think the second thing is this interesting convergence of technology and storytelling that's occurring right now on the stage. Because it happened with film many years ago as digital effects sort of seeped their way into films in the 80s and 90s, late 80s and 90s. And the way that that's changed storytelling in filmmaking is you can't even name the ways. And now it's a given and an accepted concept. But if you go back to the much more practical effect nature of the 70s and 80s, and you compare that to sort of where we are today on the digital effects side, there are stories that are told today you just could never have been told in the 70s and 80s. And I think that the convergence of varying technologies and entertainments for the live stage are starting to make inroads into the way stories are told. And I think that over the next 10 years, we're going to see even more of that. And we're going to see a lot of merging and converging of different formats and different types of technology and different types of performances that we really today can't quite imagine. So I think there's a lot of very interesting things happening. And I think there's a lot of producers and a lot of directors that are exploring those various ideas about how to better tell stories. And I think that's where a lot of the interest for me lies.
On that note, actually, you're working on musicals, plays, concerts, varying other kind of entertainment.
Yeah, circus-style performances, magic shows, everything in between.
Yeah, so how do you approach each one separately, and what are the commonalities between them? Have you seen there's certain themes where you just know that that kind of type of production will work because that's just human nature, and what things differ, what factors are different between them in delivering the shows to an audience?
Right. Well, generally, as an individual, I have a difficult time getting involved in productions that I think may be interesting for an audience, but that I personally don't believe in or don't have an affinity for. So first of all, part of what I love to do is to work with teams of people to create ideas and stories that speak to me as a human being, because that's one of the reasons that I get involved in anything that I do. So I think that, you know, first off, when I look at a new project, I ask myself, is this something I want to do? Like, this is something that I believe in that I think could be successful. Are we going to be able to do something that is new and different and that is going to be engaging for a group of people? And that's one of the good things about being involved with BASE is that we're not really genre specific. We're content specific. So we look at, can we be disruptive, or can we do something unique or special in a specific genre or area, whether it happens to be music or theater or magic or circus or any of those different disciplines and everything in between. We look to see, and I personally look to see, can I do something that is going to change the paradigm in some small or even perhaps more significant way? And that tends to be sort of how I choose what I get involved with to work on. I'll also say that personally, part of the reason that I enjoy my job is because of who I get to work with. So I also tend to gravitate to projects where I really just enjoy the people that are involved. I just believe in the people. You know, I believe that the people that are part of it are people that I want to kind of I want to, you know, go to bat with, and I want to support, because as you know, a lot of these things take many, many years to develop. And if you're not having a good time with the people, it can be
feels even longer.
It can be decades. Yeah.
I wanted to touch on audiences again a little bit. Mm-hmm. So as you said, you've done lots of different work in lots of different disciplines, also lots of different mm-hmm. territories. Mm-hmm. So for example, taking shows into Asian markets,
right.
China, Macau, Hong mm-hmm. Kong, Singapore, places like that. What did you learn from your experience working in those markets, and how did you tailor mm-hmm. the experience to the local crowd whilst also maintaining the kind of core vision that yep. you set out?
I would say that so there were two specific experiences that I would point to. One was I spent a good amount of time in South Korea doing a production of Jekyll and Hyde that ended up playing in a huge arena, an Olympic Hall in Seoul, and then toured. And then I came back a second time to do a second version of it. And it was a very interesting experience for me because that was really the first time that I had produced anything internationally. That was back in, I think, 2004-ish. It was a really an eye-opening experience because, you know, at that point, the theatrical and sort of musical theater industry, specifically in South Korea, was like the Wild West. I mean, it was literally just beginning in earnest. And what I was amazed about was how connected to the performers the audience was. I mean, I remember after the first night of shows, the performers, actors came out, and there were probably 3,000 people waiting for them as they came out of the doors. So that was a different experience. Yeah. I was like, wow, you might think the Beatles were playing in Seoul. So I would think that what was most exciting for me, to answer your question, in that process was just learning how different culturally audiences respond to work, and understanding, and that led to an understanding for me that before you go into a new territory, you really need to understand the nature of those audiences, because in a lot of cases, they're not going to respond necessarily the way that they do in America. And then that led definitely to a much more intensive experience in China, which was actually with BASE, producing something in Macau, where I spent, you know, I think at one point it was almost 6 weeks of time touring through China. This is back in 2007, where, so again, not a lot of Western entertainment in China in 2007. And I actually traveled to, I think it was 10 different locations, from small little towns in the middle of nowhere to big cities like Beijing and Shanghai, and actually just watched all of the Chinese entertainment with audiences that were local audiences, just to understand, well, what do they do? We were producing a major, you know, $20 million magic show that was going to be language independent and open in Macau. And no one had ever done anything like that there before. And we decided internally that before we invested all of this money and before we spent years of our lives on this, we wanted to understand, well, so what do people like to watch here? What do they see? So I saw everything, I'm not making this up, from talent shows in small towns to giant productions in the countryside that the director of the 2008 Olympics actually directed, where they had 100 different farmers operating spotlights. So I've seen a lot of interesting stuff there, but it was extremely informative and to help us understand what kind of show to create. And it just sort of reinforced something that is important to me, which is that, you know, I really love doing what I do I love affecting audiences. Like it's the audience that I'm always really thinking of. And we have previews of shows that if I'm directing or I'm creative director, I don't even watch the show that much. I just watch the audience. So I want to understand what experience, are they having the experience that I thought they were going to have at this moment? And if they're not, we need to reshape it to help create that. So learning about new audiences and new locations, and since then I've had the opportunity to do that in other places, and we're doing a project in the UK coming up and at the end of the year, and you know, kind of diving into those different worlds is a pretty exciting process and very eye-opening and also quite humbling. So I think it's a good process.
I really love that. That China story is great. I presume you didn't speak any Chinese at the time?
No, I had a wonderful translator that came with me. her American name was Wendy. I want to give a shout out to Wendy if she's listening. She was amazing. She had never been outside of China, but she spoke perfect English. She's probably 23, 24 years old, just out of school. And she took me from city to city. And really, if it wasn't for her, I really don't know what I would have done. We were in the middle of the countryside. I mean, like literally, I mean, 8-9 hours from anything remotely urban. So I saw a lot of interesting stuff, and it was a really unique experience, and I'm so glad that I had it.
So as someone who's really fascinated by the way an audience responds, I suppose, by not being able to speak the language, you're having to tap into body language, eye contact, visual cues. Yeah.
And also, you know, I think that the audiences there are just a little bit different. They don't react quite the same way that American audiences do throughout the show. They tend to sort of save a lot of their reaction to towards the end of the show. So part of it was just understanding, like, are they even enjoying any of this? But also, I wanted to understand, in that case, it was also about understanding, like, what the role of magic was in performance in China. And one of the things that I learned is that they don't really have a ton of like unique just magic shows, but magic is usually in almost every show that they do. In other words, they don't necessarily have David Copperfield style magic shows, but if they have a variety show, you can be sure that there's going to be a magic act in it. And if they have a circus show, you can be sure there's going to be some creative use of the magic in it. So it was that kind of a process that was really interesting and unique for me to learn about.
With that one particularly, actually, it's quite interesting to think about the process that you went through to get mm-hmm. to get that show going. What mm-hmm. what made you think that there was a market there, and for the particular property you were working on, what process did you guys go through with research and figuring out when to launch and how to launch?
So I'm going to be honest. When I got on the project, they had already done research on the type of show. And basically when they hired me, they said, we need to do a magic show, but we have no idea what to do. We need an independent creative director / producer to develop something that's going to be right for this market. No one has ever produced from the United States, a magic specific show, language independent show, not featuring a star in Macau. We need to figure out how to do that. So those
constraints again, yeah. I guess.
So they gave us those constraints, and then we did a bunch of that sort of on the ground research. And then I developed a concept. I had initially developed a concept for the pitch way back when. But then going there, it sort of redirected the concept and refined the idea, which then led to a pretty specific and clear treatment that we then did a bunch of testing on in Hong Kong and in other areas in China. And one of the interesting things was that, I mean, I'm a really firm believer that if you can't do research effectively on something that people have never seen. In other words, you can't rely on the research to tell you whether or not someone's going to like a particular show, because they can't envision the show that you're going to create. Like if you were to explain to somebody Hamilton, for example, having never seen it, no idea what it is, and you were to list off all the characteristics of the show, someone would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. How is that going to fit together? It's really the whole that matters. And it's that that Henry Ford quote, the one where he's like, if I had asked people what I should make, it would be a faster horse. You know, it's that, right? So what we can test, though, I think, is whether or not conceptually a lot of the ideas that we're talking about resonate with people. And I think that when we did that, we spent a lot of time and money doing that in the market to understand, okay, are these ideas and these concepts that we're developing, are they things that the Chinese community will embrace? Of course, the execution is the critical component, but if we're not starting out with the right ingredients, then what's the point? So we did do quite a bit of research. I remember sitting there behind the glass in Hong Kong and in a couple other cities, watching the moderator sort of explain what we were doing and then listening to the reactions. And it was a pretty unique experience.
Where else would you love to go and take a show that you haven't already? Is there a particular territory or country that you'd love to mm-hmm. to visit and launch something?
Yeah, you know, I've always wanted to do to do a little bit more work in Europe. I have some friends that have produced some really incredible, and written some incredible shows for Vienna and for Budapest and a number of other, you know, major European cities. And I really haven't had an opportunity to do much of that. So I would really, I love that area of the world. I think it's one of the most beautiful areas in the world. And I just would love the opportunity to develop something for that area. You know, I enjoyed spending time in Japan, but I've never produced a show for the Japanese market. So I think I would have, I have a lot of friends now that live in Japan and that have been involved with us in other productions. And I'm hoping that someday soon I'll be able to do something there.
On that note, let's talk about some of Bass's new projects, which are going very international. There's a new hologram division, which has been fairly recently launched, am I right?
Very, yeah.
Very recent. So the concept of holograms goes back kind of to the 19th century originally, right?
Yeah, I mean,
we think about Tupac Shakur at Coachella for most of us is what we think about holograms on stage. It's been around for a while.
Yeah.
Putting all that together with, you've got Maria Callas and Roy Orbison currently in production or onto currently.
Roy Orbison is launching literally in the UK in a matter of a month or so. So it's happening quickly.
Yeah. Can you maybe talk us through where the idea for these two particularly and the hologram division generally came from?
So Brian Becker, the CEO of the company, is definitely the impresario of the hologram world and business for Bass. But I think I can speak to it in his stead a little bit. I think that, you know, Brian is a brilliant businessman, and he tends to approach things from that point of view. I think that one of the things that interests Brian is the sort of interesting convergence of technology, content, and business model. And on the technology side, while conceptually the hologram concept has been around for a long time, there are just a lot more tools available to us today to do things with holograms that perhaps could not have been done, as you mentioned, hundreds of years ago, or even, to be honest, 10 years ago. So technologically, the tools have advanced, and that allows for sort of the opportunity to develop new kinds of content that thus far have not been really clearly or fully explored. And that is everything from giving the audiences the experience of what it was like to see a performer that is no longer with us, all the way through to creating new content where there are live performers and holograms of performers or holograms of characters interacting and, you know, experiencing something on the same stage. So I think that there's on the content side, there's a lot of interesting opportunities that are sort of tied in part to the technology. And then on the business model side, I think that one of the things that intrigued Brian is the scalability of the projects. So it takes a certain amount of effort to create it, right? But once you create it, it's really a hard drive and some projection equipment in terms of how to then scale it from location to location. So whereas on a traditional, let's just say, Broadway tour, you know, you basically have to recreate the Broadway show for the road. In this case, the entire show really exists, or a significant portion of it exists in a box. And that box can travel wherever it needs to, and you can add components to it, but the core creative content for something like Maria Callas or for Roy Orbison, that work has already been complete. And now you're just scaling that from location to location to location. So I think that those three things together, and he would do a much better job of explaining this than I would, but those three things together, I think, really piqued his interest. And kind of combining forces with some industry veterans that have been sort of sniffing around that technology for many years, I think has resulted in a really exciting business model that, you know, I think everyone is hopeful is going to carry the company through the next 10 years.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. There's a couple of primer videos on the Bass site, and I'd recommend anyone listening to check them out. They're really interesting. And obviously, people probably know the Tupac thing, but I think that's, what, 5-6 years old now. The technology's obviously moved along. The Roy Orbison and Maria Callas ones, for example, they're both touring properties, right? So the Roy Orbison show is going across Europe, I think, in the next couple of months. So that looks like band and orchestra.
Mm-hmm. A live band.
Live bands.
Orchestra, yeah.
Yep. That will tour like a regular live band. And then there'll be the technical component on top.
Yeah, so it depends on the situation, but it could be anything, any version of, you know, a live band that then picks up orchestras from city to city. It could be just with an orchestra. There's a bunch of different ways to scale it, but I think the point you're making is that, yes, so it's a hologram of Roy Orbison, a hologram that depicts sort of Roy Orbison performing, but it is done with live performers and live performances sort of interacting directly with that holographic image. So it's not like you're going and seeing a film, basically, where there's just a bunch of holograms on the stage. What's interesting for bass is the sort of the interaction and the confluence of both that sort of holographic image and the live component. And I think that the goal eventually is to go well even beyond that and have there really be almost no differentiation between the holographic image and the live performer. So it's all just performance. And I think that, you know, that's a process, of course. That's not like turn the lights on, it happens. But I think that the goal is to be able to do some things utilizing that technology and that storytelling technique that really sort of create sort of completely new ways of storytelling.
How did the creative process work to actually get the first initial amount of content for the hologram show
It was a long process because there's the whole sort of process before everything starts, which is working with the Orbison estate and getting all of those rights and understanding sort of what the estate thought about how this should be done. But then there was the process of basically hiring a director, in the case of Roy Orbison, I believe it's Eric Schaefer, who understands that musical style and has developed a number of shows over the years that sort of from that era. And he worked with our team to then basically, you know, develop the actual hologram, which was, you know, a process that involves, you know, shooting and effects and a bunch of different things that have to happen, all based on the original performances of Roy Orbison. And then there's the technological component where bass spent a good amount of time understanding, since it's going to tour and it needs to be flexible enough to go into a variety of different venues, sort of understanding what technological hurdles there were to accomplishing the goals. And then, of course, there's the whole musical component, making sure that the music is as perfect as it can be, and making sure that the live arrangements and the live performances that are happening match with the recorded vocals. So it's a pretty substantial, you know, process that they've had to go through. And, you know, this is crunch time. Like, over the next month, as they launch this tour, this is a pretty unique thing. I mean, launching a hologram tour around the UK is not something that happens every day. It is going to be a very interesting process.
As I said, watching the primer videos, it's emotively it's very strong. I think it's interesting what you say about eventually the whole thing will become a performance, and I think an audience will suspend our disbelief. Right. I think it's really interesting. I imagine initially there was probably some resistance or pushback either from an estate or from fans to think, this feels a bit strange or it doesn't feel appropriate. Did you guys feel that there was that pushback?
You know, I can only speak for the way that I think about it, which is that I don't think that it should ever be looked at as basically trying to copy a human being. I think it needs to be looked at as a way of paying tribute to a person. Because it's not really possible to, as you can understand, I mean, you know, what makes a performer successful is an entire sort of list of things that they're capable of doing on stage and how they interact with the audience and how the music is structured and how they perform the music and everything from their facial impressions to the vocal inflection to everything in between. It's such a broad spectrum of things that I don't think anybody's interested in cloning someone and put them on the stage. I think what is interesting, though, is finding ways to pay tribute to those people who were such... you know, had such were such sort of pioneers in the industry, were the people that sort of had a real emotional impact on fans around the world. Giving people a taste of that and a sense of how important those individuals were and are, I think is really what the goal is. So I don't get too caught up personally in worrying about offending people, because I don't think that bass or anybody else that I know that's in this particular part of the industry is really trying to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. I think, in fact, that's quite the opposite. It's to say there are so many people that never got to experience Maria Callas live. To give you a taste of what that was like will help you appreciate who she was and what she did for the industry even more. So I think that that's the approach that we generally have taken. And I think that the estates, every estate's going to be different, right? I mean, some estates are going to get that and they're going to certainly embrace that idea. Others just, well, and that's okay. And I think that's why I think that, you know, it's not just with holograms, but you find that same, those same issues when we start talking about, you know, the catalogs of various bands and doing those on stage and doing, making those into musicals. Some bands are thrilled about that idea. Some would never allow it to happen. So I think it really is a case by case basis. But I think the most important thing is to continue to make sure that the audiences understand that this is a way to sort of pay tribute to these people, not to try to replicate them.
I think the technology generally is really interesting. Mm-hmm. And we've spoken to a few VR companies on this podcast before. Mm-hmm. And just generally in conversation, talking with VR companies in music or entertainment, sports, other areas. How do you see this differing from VR? Because presumably in the future, somebody could put on a VR headset and be in a Roy Orbison concert. Do you think this complements a VR experience or conflicts with it?
I think that... So I have gone down the road a few times already, looking at ways of utilizing VR in some of our projects. And I think that, again, nobody has yet quite figured out the right way to scale that project commercially, especially for large sort of live entertainment audiences. Part of it is because the experience is personal. Obviously, you're putting on something, and even if you're in a room with other people, the fact is that thus far, that VR experience is something that you're having on your own, whereas theatrical or concert experiences, part of what makes them unique is the shared nature of the experience. In fact, in a lot of ways, it's the opposite of VR, because VR is sort of the culmination of where technology has been going with us on smartphones and tablets and, you know, everything in your face, and it's all about your interaction directly with the technology. And to me, the last vestige of what entertainment was for the past, you know, 1,000 years, the last vestige of that really is theater and concert performances. Because where else can you sit in an audience with a group of people and have a shared experience? There, sporting events, and the movie theater. That's about all that's left. So it used to be that those experiences were everywhere. Now they're confined to a very small number of things. And I think that the hologram experience, when we're talking about performance-wise, is really more akin to sort of continuing that tradition of having a shared experience, even though it's with technology, versus something like VR, which I think has wonderful merits, but I consider it more of a sort of a personalized, sort of almost individual experience, not something that necessarily at this point is sort of shared with a room of people. Because I'm sure that you have been in an experience where you've been in a movie theater and you've watched a movie and the theater is laughing, everyone's laughing so loud that your experience in the movie is, the movie's even funnier than it would be otherwise. Then you watch the movie like 3 years later by yourself and you don't laugh anywhere near as much as you did in that theater. And that's part of the reason that those sort of gathering places for entertainment are so important, because it enhances the experience. And I think that the hologram world that we're talking about is really a new way or a different way of delivering great, potentially great content, but it maintains that sense of community, which I think is important.
Yeah, I think the gathering place is a really interesting way of putting it. I agree with that a lot. Let's talk about gathering places for other bass projects. Mm-hmm. What this year, what have you got coming up? What's exciting you?
Well, we have a lot of things going on. We have a new project that we're launching with NBC and Talpa Media, which is based on The Voice television show. And it's called The Voice Neon Dreams. It's a live show that's opening in a custom-built theater in Las Vegas. And the theater was constructed around this concept that we wanted to create a modern musical spectacular, but do it in a way that felt intimate and personal. So we designed a theater space where the show happens all the way around the audience. and the audience is literally immersed in the music, the musicians, and the performances. So instead of sitting back 100, 200, 300 feet away and watching a performer on stage, the stage is all around you, and no one is more than, let's say, you know, 15 or 20 feet from stage, somewhere in the space. So it's kind of a unique way of thinking about music. Part of what inspired it was a series of projects that I worked on many years ago, where we were able to take artists and musicians and basically throw genre out the window and do one concert that sort of encompassed all of the different sort of musical styles that we loved. And we focused on great melodies and great songs, iconic melodies, iconic songs, not at all genre specific. So it could be Puccini or it could be Led Zeppelin. It could be both. And I think that creating a musical experience for people that is sort of like a God's playlist, where if God had a playlist, this is what it would be. And doing that in a way where the violin player is 5 feet from you instead of 500 feet from you is really exciting for me. So we're launching that with NBC. We've been, you know, we've had some performances on The Voice show. We just had one in December. And this coming season, we're going to have some really great integrations with the television show. So we have some great partners on that, and it's been a long time coming. So that's opening in September. And then I'm working on, we launched Magic Mike Live with Channing Tatum's production in Las Vegas, which is Channing, this is well documented, I'm not breaking any news here, but Channing, as he was coming into the industry for a period of time, for like a 1 year period of time, he was actually a stripper. And when he was doing that, he was sort of appalled by a lot of the way that women were treated in a lot of these things, these events that were supposed to be for women, but they were just treated appallingly. And he developed a real interest in finding a way to create a show that felt like it was by women for women. So that, you know, you take the idea of the male review that is so traditionally understood, you throw it out the window, and you say, if we are creating a show for a modern woman, that is basically a high-end male variety show, how would we do that? And what it turned into was Channing and the creative team for the show, obviously developing two films, Magic Mike and Magic Mike XXL, but then this being almost like the third installment was this sort of live show. And it was an $8.5 million production put into a 400-seat theater. So you're really experiencing something that has the production value of any of the big shows in Las Vegas, but has this sense of intimacy and care and thoughtfulness and respect that is sort of potentially has been missing from that genre for many years. So that show launched in Las Vegas last March, and it's been doing great at the Hard Rock Hotel and Casino. And now we're taking that show and we're going to be bringing that show to the UK. So we're working on that to open towards the end of 2018. And then we have, you know, there's obviously a lot going on in the hologram world. There's not a lot that I can actually talk about today, but there's a lot of projects that they're looking at beyond just Roy Orbison and Maria Callas. A lot of interesting options across a variety of different mediums. So everything from location-based entertainment all the way through to obviously Broadway-style shows. And then we have, you know, there's another magic project that we've been working on that is a interesting sort of new approach, very small scale, intentionally meant to be very personal in a unique environment. And then we have another project that is sort of a reinvention of the traditional circus, doing something that is story-based, heavily story-based, that delivers a totally unified sort of scenic, visual, and storytelling experience that we're working on. I've been working on now for about 3 or 4 years that hopefully will start making major inroads in 2018. So
amazing. I'm interested to know, I like to ask this one.
Yeah.
I think a lot of us in media entertainment, we often have tales of maybe one that we've missed out on or the opportunity that we overlooked. Have you got one that you maybe look back wistfully and think that was the one that perhaps got away that you just didn't see at the time?
Well, I wouldn't say that so much. I mean, I think that in most cases, I can't think of a one particular show where I was like, oh, wow, I didn't invest in Avenue Q. God, I should have done that. I mean, I don't really have any of those, or Rent. But I can say that the one thing that I'm the most sorry about is that, you know, the project in Macau that we spent so much time and money developing, it actually never got finished because the financial crisis hit in 2008, and all the construction in Macau basically stopped for a period of many years. In fact, I remember the Las Vegas Sands Corporation, who we were doing the project with, I remember looking on the computer and seeing their stock had dropped from, I don't know how many hundreds of dollars a share to like a dollar. So as you can imagine, the tens of billions of dollars of construction projects around the world that they had just stopped. So I would say if there's any one project that I feel like got away, it's that I really believed in that show. We spent years and a lot of money developing something that was really unique for the Chinese market, that needed to be produced in a very unique venue that we were custom building to hold it. And I feel like that would have been a pretty groundbreaking show in Asia. And I regret not having the opportunity to see that one through. So that would be probably the one that I would pick on that front.
Just to change lanes a little before we wrap up. So you've served on the boards of a few arts and cultural trusts and institutions. What role do you see those institutions playing in the future? Do you think they're going to become more important? I know in the UK, for example, the Arts Council has come under a lot of funding pressure in the last few years with recessions and referendums and that kind of thing. In the US or more broadly, where do you see the role of arts and cultural trusts?
Well, I think there's a couple of problems that we're all dealing with, one of which is that the World War II generation, which was so critical to arts funding around the United States, is really not participating on the level, obviously, that they once were because of their aging out. And I think that the baby boomer generation, this is a broad generalization, of course, has and grew up with different priorities than their parents did. I think that a lot of the World War II generation would subscribe to theaters and to orchestras and to operas and to ballets because they felt that the institution was important. That it wasn't so much that they wanted to see the show specifically. It was that they felt that that art form and that cultural institution for the community was critical. And I think that there are a number of trusts and culture and cultural institutions that were built around that concept. And my concern is that as time goes, I mean, some of those institutions are well-funded and have endowments that will last them for God forever. But there's a lot that also don't, that rely on consistent support and family support and donor support. And I do worry about that in the long term, because I feel as if there has been a shift away from that sort of support institutionally, supporting the institution versus supporting the show. And I worry that, and I think it's very important that the established trusts and the established organizations that have the ability to fund continue to do so and to be bold and robust in their funding, because over time, I worry and question whether or not we're going to be able to continue to develop that sort of donor culture in the way that it was 40 or 50 years ago. So that's sort of my comment there. I would say that I do think that, and I know I'm a relatively, especially economically conservative person, but I would say that one of the areas that I do believe deeply in is that I do believe that the government overall has a, just as it has since, you know, medieval times and Roman times, has an obligation to support cultural institutions in the country. And I think that it's really very self-serving. It's because I think that those institutions are really important to what we were talking about, that idea of community and the idea of being able to bring people together around a common understanding and a common goal. We have a lot of things that divide us, but those cultural institutions are things that would always and consistently bring people together. And I think that there's a governmental interest, whether you're here in Europe or in Asia, in finding ways to continue that, because I think it knits us together in ways that are nationalistically important. So, you know, I whenever I'm asked to serve on those institutions and those boards, I try to do so, because I just think that they're so critical and important in a very changing donor landscape.
Last question before we wrap. This is going to be hard given what we've just talked about over the whole conversation. Your personal most memorable live experience, either in a work capacity or just as an audience member and a fan? That's going to be tough.
That's a hard question. Well, I can give you a couple answers, I guess.
Feel free to give a couple.
I guess when I was a kid, when I had that teacher that introduced me to the theater, I had never been to a Broadway show, and my parents took me. This was like 1986. My parents took me to see Phantom of the Opera, and it was just had come out. It was just on Broadway, and now we know it's been there. That shows how old I am now, but it's been there for many years, and it was life-changing for me, because I had never seen anything like that. I mean, it was so new and different, and Michael Crawford was the lead, and Sarah Brightman was the soprano, and the technology was seemed so ahead of its time, and I just didn't have any idea that a live entertainment experience could be anything like that. So for a kid from South Jersey, it was very, very eye-opening, and certainly something that broadened my thinking and horizons about, you know, what I may be able to do later on. So there's that. I would say that, you know, creatively, I have a lot of things that I am certainly proud of. Personally, I would say that I had developed a show with Frank Wildhorn and Jack Murphy. You know, Frank did Jekyll and Hyde and Scarlet Pimpernel and Civil War and a bunch of shows on Broadway over the years. But we had done a show about Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald that to this day I really love. I always loved it. And a wonderful performer named Lauren Kennedy played the Zelda Fitzgerald role. And doing and directing that show and being a part of the process of creating that work, even to this day, even though it wasn't on the scale of everything, all the other stuff that I did, it's still one of the more special experiences of my life. And then I would say that most recently, one of the most unique experiences I ever had was definitely during the first few previews of Magic Mike Live with Channing in Las Vegas, because the women in the audience went so crazy during the show that they were screaming happily so loud at the end that you couldn't think. Like, you couldn't even... I had never been in a performance space that was quite like that. It was almost like the end of the show was almost like a party environment that is hard to really explain. And one of the reasons for that is because the venue, we literally built and constructed every part of the venue around the show. So every table, every couch was custom made, every piece, every artwork on the wall was chosen. Like, it was a very specific, you know, venue for 450 people. And I have never been in a place where people were screaming so loud. Now, part of it could have been because Channing was there. So here, of course, I'm sure they were cheering for Channing. But honestly, I think that they were cheering because they felt like finally somebody did something that was really for them and kind of got it right. You know, it wasn't like it was a guy imposing his way of thinking about what women want. It was actually a group of people that spent a lot of time and energy really trying to understand what can we do to create something that feels like it's by women for women. And I feel like we were able to achieve that on some level. And I think that their responses to that were sort of cathartic. You know, it was like, wow, finally. So recently, I will say, I remember sitting in the theater or standing in the theater and saying to the person next to me and saying, yeah, I've never heard of anything like this. So those are my three answers, I guess.
Amazing. Vincent, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
I enjoyed it very much. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Join us next time for another edition of Tickets. You can subscribe via Apple Podcasts and Stitcher, or listen back through SoundCloud and Acast. Tickets is an HBRO production. Find out more at hbro.com.